The Guardian.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2013 with Claire Armitstead.
Hello and welcome to day three of our daily Edinburgh podcasts. We're all a bit hungover today, the effect of too many cupcakes and cokes, you understand, because yesterday was the shortlisting party for the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize. It's the first time we've announced it at the festival. Loads of young writers turned up, as well as an array of star authors. It's a handy reminder that though most of our coverage is of adult books, this is a thriving children's festival too.
My name's Jojo Reed, I'm 17, and I reviewed The Fault in Our Stars by John Green. I thought it was a very enjoyable book with really relatable and great main characters, and it's pretty much the book that I recommend to all of my friends.
I'm Aisha, and I read Maggot Moon by Sally Gardner. It's a really good book, and I would highly recommend it. It's about a boy, and he's always getting in trouble in class, and then he has an argument with his best friend, and it all kind of goes downhill from there. I'm not going to spoil the plot for you.
I'm Molly Duffield. I've read The Fault in Our Stars by John Green, and I thought it was absolutely fabulous. I've read it twice. Can't get enough of it. I thought it was very realistic, considering it was written by someone who clearly hasn't been in that situation. You know, it's about a 15-year-old or like 16-year-old girl, and obviously John Green's not a 16-year-old girl. So I thought it was very true to people of our age group and like their interests and how they would feel in that situation. I thought it was really heart-wrenching as well. The ending was really, really sad, but there was a sort of uplifting as well in the same way.
Thank you all for coming. It's wonderful to be here in Edinburgh and to have taken this departure of announcing the shortlist for the award here at the festival in the heart of such a buzzy, vibrant and excited children's book. I know it's an adult festival as well, but the part that's around children's books. And of course, it's wonderful for us particularly to be here because of having so many young critics in the room. The Guardian Children's Book Prize was launched in 1967. It was set up as a kind of rival to the Carnegie Medal, which was judged by librarians. And the whole point about the Guardian Children's Book Prize is it's judged by other children's writers. Jacqueline Wilson has won it. Meg Rosoff has won it. And today, I am going to now hand over to Frank Cottrell Boyce, who won the prize last year and is going to now announce the 2013 shortlist.
The other thing that Julie didn't say about this award is that you can only win it once. So it's the award that your publisher doesn't really want you to win, they want you to be nominated a lot. I will now just read the shortlist, and it's brilliant, actually. It's really fantastic. I've read loads of these books already. The Boy Who Swam With Piranhas by David Almond. The Fault Is In Our Stars by John Green. Rooftoppers by Catherine Rundle. And Liar and Spy by Rebecca Stead.
I'm Julia Eccleshare. I'm chair of the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize. So the wonderful thing about this shortlist is the range of writing there is for children at the moment. People tend to underestimate just how diverse children's books can be. So if you start with something like David Almond's The Boy Who Swam With Piranhas, it's an incredible fable. I mean, it's a ridiculous, magical adventure, but it's actually a fable about the whole of life, really. And people tend to think children's books are just stories for the nursery, and this is a complete myth. They are much, much bigger than that. You then get something completely different, like Rooftoppers by Catherine Rundle, which is a fantastic adventure set on the Paris rooftops with a child who lives amongst the pigeons. He kills pigeons and eats them. It's rather disgusting. But the whole adventure is about being free, finding yourself. Its structure is, in a sense, an old-fashioned adventure, but it feels totally contemporary for today. And then the last two titles on the list, John Green's The Fault in Our Stars and Rebecca Stead's Liar and Spies. These are books with really meaty issues. These are books about dying, really, and in both of these, that is lurking in the background. But they're not books which in any sense make you gloomy. They're books which encourage children to think about the worst things that can happen around you, but how actually you can manage and cope and face up to things. And they're books supported, in both cases, in which children are very much supported by friendship. And I think they capture the reality of childhood. Childhood is not a protected space. Childhood is a time when you are, to a certain extent, sheltered. But I don't think children nowadays have no fears. I think they know the world can be a dangerous place. And I think children's fiction is brilliant at humorously, excitingly, and adventurously exploring the biggest issues there are.
Hi, my name is Frances Meyer. I'm a member of the Guardian Children's Books website, and I'm here tonight to find out a bit more about the books on the long list and decide which one I might like to review for the competition.
May the best book win. One of the themes of this year's festival is women in the 21st century, but we're looking back to earlier generations. Kari Herbert's book, Heart of the Hero, looks at the lives of seven polar wives. That's the great women behind great polar explorers like Shackleton and Scott, to name just two of them. Judith McCrell's Flappers, Women of a Dangerous Generation, looks at a rather different kind of adventurer. As one of her 1920s subjects quipped, "My father warned me about men and booze, but never mentioned women and cocaine." Judith, who was that?
That was Tallulah Bankhead as a very, very lively teenager, having just left her southern conservative family and come up to New York in order to be an actress, and learning very quickly that a very quick and witty one-liner will be get you a long way in the PR stakes.
Kari, I'm going to start with you. You deal with seven women, and your first was born in the late 18th century, 1795, and the most recent is, in fact, your mother.
It was actually very hard choosing the women, because when you look back throughout history and the extraordinary polar explorers, quite often you find that there's an extraordinary woman, as we all say, great woman behind a great man. And so actually it was quite hard. So eventually I just decided just on the women themselves and their extraordinary stories. And it just so happened that also included Shackleton and Scott, these best loved heroes of polar exploration. So I look at Eleanor Franklin, who was an epic poet of her time. She sadly died quite young, so Franklin married again to the indomitable Jane Franklin, who is the sort of epitome, really, of a polar wife. And then I look at Eva Nansen, the wife of the Norwegian explorer Fridtjof Nansen. She was an incredible singer, very famous singer of her time, singing deep, passionate Leda songs. I look at Emily Shackleton, and I look at Kathleen Scott, the wonderful bohemian sculptress who was an extraordinary character. And also my mother, who was Mary Herbert, married to Sir Wally Herbert, my lovely dad, who was a fantastic polar explorer. And in a sense, the sort of last link between the heroic age of exploration and modern adventuring, I suppose we call it today.
It was a period that went between the end of the Napoleonic Wars, when suddenly everybody needed a new sort of heroism, to the moon landings. And your father was unfortunate enough to return from his big first expedition on just when the Apollo landings were happening.
Actually, for a fairly short period of time, a lot happened, well, globally, of course, but historically and in exploration, a huge amount happened in that time. Some of the best pioneering journeys, our best stories of adventure happen in this period. And I wanted to particularly concentrate on the time of exploration where there was no communication whatsoever, so men could be away for years at a time, up to maybe 5 years at a time, with no contact with home. So there'd be no radios, of course, and certainly no satellite telephones, which we all use as polar explorers today to contact home on a nightly basis. And that's a really fascinating side of exploration, I think.
You have a story of them putting 5 letters on 5 different boats, just so that one of them might get there.
Yes, the only way of communicating for most of these women was to write several copies of the same letter and put them on different whaling ships in the hope that one might run into her husband's expedition or be put in a cairn somewhere up north, and that they'll sort of be relayed further north until they reach their destination. So it was all a very hit and miss affair. And I think perhaps one of the most poignant examples of that this terribly tragic story of Josephine Peary trying to contact her husband. She'd fallen pregnant just before he left on one of his expeditions, and the child was born and died as an infant. And so she's trying to tell her husband this awfully painful news, and imagine trying to write the same grief-stricken letter. She actually wrote 6 of these letters and sent them off with 6 different whaling ships. And I found 3 of these letters in different archives. And the pain running through these letters is just unimaginable. And I can't imagine writing that letter once, let alone 6 times. And none of those letters actually reached her husband. She had to find other ways. She had to actually go and raise funds to go to the Arctic to get him, bring him home, tell him the news herself. So that's a pretty extreme way of telling your husband news like that.
So your women are defined in relationship to their men. I mean, they had lives of their own, their husbands. Your women, Judith, didn't really have husbands, did they, or not many of them?
If they did, they treated them badly, or were perceived to have treated them badly. Yes, I mean, I was interested in writing this group biography of the 1920s, essentially, because it seemed to me a period in which a historic number of women were actually trying to live their lives independently of marriage and motherhood and men. It's partly to do with the First World War having decimated an entire generation. It's partly to do with women getting the vote and having access to jobs and professions that they didn't have access to before. And just to a general spirit of experiment, of interest in freedom as a concept, very unlike Carrie's rather more dutiful, sacrificial women, who wanted to go out and live life by their own roadmap rather than being told what to do either by their parents or their husbands. Writing the book, that was both sort of exhilarating to see the kinds of journeys they went on, the kind of adventures they had, the kinds of freedoms they took, but also how difficult it was to try and have it all, in the sense of those that had careers and did want to fall in love, did have children, how difficult it was to find a new mold, really, for being a new woman that embraced everything. So, I mean, my women were very much defined by their careers or their public images. I've got Diana Cooper and Tallulah Bankhead, who are both actors. Tamara de Lempicka, who's a great painter of that period. Josephine Baker, obviously, extraordinary icon of the jazz era. Zelda Fitzgerald, who was the sort of original flapper muse of her husband Scott, but then very much a writer in her own right. I mean, all these women had extraordinarily performative lives. They took centre stage. And those that then also tried to become mothers and wives, or even just to have long-term love affairs, they did find it very difficult, I think, to figure out a life that would contain all that.
One of the things that these books have in common is that they are both in a way about celebrity, and particularly how women negotiate celebrity, aren't they? Tell us about, Carrie, about the celebrity in your book, which isn't an obvious idea.
No, it's not, but it's absolutely crucial to an expedition is to have good publicity, because sponsors were needed for all the early expeditions right through to modern day expeditions now, where everybody is heavily branded up. And Shackleton was one of the most, I don't know, he was a sort of pin-up really for Burberry and all sorts, and that was how he got his money to go. And the women also needed to shore that up when the men were away. So if a man's away for 5 years at a time, someone has to keep the public profile up, otherwise the sponsors aren't happy, the money doesn't keep coming. You can't send a relief expedition if everybody's forgotten about what the expedition's trying to do. So some of the women were much better at it than others. Josephine Peary was extraordinary. She knew how to best milk the press. So she told her own story many, many times. She had these wonderful photo shoots, which are beautiful images of her at home, this very elegant woman dressed in the latest fashions with a polar bear skin on the floor, and her sitting at a piano with this incredible, beautiful dress that's draped behind her, and these Eskimo artifacts all around, a picture of her child, the snow baby, dressed up in full Inuit gear. And they're very carefully posed to be the sort of Penelope waiting for her husband to come home, but reminding people that it was a very elegant affair, a very heroic affair, but also a very elegant one, if you like. And she did very well at keeping him in the public profile, even though he wasn't a very likeable person, so that the sponsors still kept the expeditions going.
So Kathleen and Robert Scott were the Posh and Becks of their time, you write, at one point, rather unexpectedly.
They really were. Yes, they really were. You have to imagine that these were the absolute superstars of their day. And they'd seen everywhere, paparazzi, all that kind of thing in its early heyday. And no, they were scrutinised. Their lives were scrutinised. They were held up as being these fantastic heroes. And the women were often, even though Kathleen Scott was much braver in many respects, she was certainly more charismatic than Scott was, and she's always sort of cut out of the picture, which I found absolutely fascinating given the strength of her personality. I found a piece of footage the other day by Herbert Ponting, and it's one of the later expeditions, Scott's last expedition, as they're about to leave port, and there's this wonderful footage of Scott laughing and joking, talking to someone, and all you can see is the rim of her hat. And I just thought, that just says it all. You know, here's this woman, and it doesn't make any sense. Who's he talking to? But it's Kathleen Scott, his wife, and she is, you know, the sort of second in command.
Judith, your women would never just be seen by the rim of their hat, would they?
They wouldn't even be wearing hats, probably.
These are very close cuts.
Yes, they would. I mean, celebrity got more and more interesting to me as I was writing the book, because although, obviously, there were celebrities long before, the 20s was really the age of modern celebrity in the sense that the machinery was gearing up so fast. I mean, it was the age of radio, of cinema, gramophone records, and of the popular press, all of which were expanding at an extraordinary rate. So, for instance, Diana Cooper, when she went on tour with this production, The Miracle, went on a very early local radio station and spoke to 20 million people. If you think that someone like Sarah Bernhardt, who before the First World War had been an extraordinary icon in some senses, but she still had to actually go physically from town to town to appear, whereas Theda Bara or those screen icons could be seen nightly in small towns all over Europe and all over America.
Your women had quite a Faustian pact with the new media age, didn't they? I mean, they relied on celebrity photographers like Man Ray to soften and promote them.
They all had careers that they were talented and hardworking at, but the sort of extra dimension of their lives was very much as icons of the 20s. And the popular press, which was expanding hugely during this period, could not get enough of images of them, descriptions of them, what they did, what they wore. And that, to me, was a very interesting dynamic with other women who were less well-known, less privileged, less talented, in the sense that what these women wore, what they were seen photographed in, the kind of body language of those women, set the fashion for an extraordinary number of ordinary working women. I mean, when Tallulah Bankhead was on stage in the West End in the 20s, when she cut her hair and pictures of her were seen in the press with her with short hair, all her fans would go to the theatre and then start cutting off their hair during a show, shouting, "Tallulah, Tallulah," and throwing down the hanks of their hair as a kind of homage, as a tribute to this woman on stage. So that was an interesting relationship. But I think also, rather like modern celebrities now, I think they were unaware of how much life lived in the public would be problematic for them. And I particularly felt it with Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald, who were the sort of pin-up couple of the 1920s. Those two were photographed everywhere. And the trouble was that the image that they created of their mutual celebrity, in the end, it was too small to contain both of them. They had to carry on doing these extraordinary, outrageous things to get in the papers, to sell the novels that would then fund their celebrity lifestyle. But when Zelda wanted to write, when she wanted a life of her own, when Scott actually wanted to settle down and not be the kind of scribe of the flapper era, but to write more serious books, it was very hard of them to get outside the mould that they'd created for themselves.
One of the things that's quite striking is the way they changed their bodies. They became quite anorexic almost, didn't they? I mean, you could say this was the age when anorexia sort of became a mass thing.
They were certainly, most of them, troubled about their weight. It's for sure. I mean, in one sense, the wet 20s was fantastically liberating for women's clothes. I mean, they literally shed a stone in weight in terms of throwing off bustles and corsets and stays and heavy outfits for what were essentially just, you know, flapper shifts and little silk cami knickers. So it was wonderfully liberating, but it did require that you were breastless and hipless. And for these women out in the public eye, there was certainly for some of them quite a troubling relationship with their weight and with their body image. I mean, the 20s was a huge era of dance and physical fitness. People were very body conscious. I always think it has a lot to do with that, with abstract art as well, that somehow in the 20s, the whole Art Deco style, the new abstract painting, even you're seeing abstract ballet, the idea of the sort of geometry even extends to women's form.
There's a sense that clothes kept them back, and this comes very strongly out of your story, Kari, that... Sorry, I've said it right. This comes very strongly out of your story, Kari, that actually you couldn't go to the polls in a crinoline, could you? Or could you?
Well, you sort of could, actually. I mean, Jo Peary went with her Sunday finest. It's incredible seeing pictures of her in a thick woolen dresses that, you know, skirt the snow, and, you know, very heavy but highly brocaded outfits standing next to an Inuit family. You know, it's just looks so out of place. And I think later on she was a bit more relaxed about it. When she's in the far north, no one's really going to see what she's looking like, so then she adopted some much more relaxed styles. But certainly whenever it was someone's birthday, she would dress up in a beautiful tea gown and do her hair and make herself look beautiful. Jane Franklin managed to scale mountains in her corsets and finery and big dresses, and it was only really Eva Nansen who said this is completely ridiculous. She was a pioneering skier as well as a beautiful singer, and she decided to adopt a sort of loose trousers, if you like, rather than the ridiculous skirts that all her contemporary women were skiing in, and became a champion skier as a result. And Nansen thought this was absolutely wonderful, but all the men, other men on the slopes, were horrified and wondering whether she was a boy or a girl.
These are quite different books in one respect, that your book, Judith, is a book of synthesis. You've got all these lives, but we know quite a lot about these lives. So what you're doing is finding a sense in them. And Kari, your book has an awful lot of original research in it. So tell us about what sort of original artefacts you found that have gone into it, and how did you get access to them?
It was quite a process to discover some of these stories. Very luckily, there are some incredible archives in this country. There's the Scott Polar Research Institute, which has a fantastic archive. And Jane Franklin's materials, all her journals from her whole lifetime, in fact, are in the Scott Polar. And only kept because of the fame of her husband. The owner was going to burn them all, and then someone said, well, it might be interesting because there might be something about her husband's expeditions in them. The only reason that her things are kept, and actually she was far more well-travelled than her husband and actually a fascinating character. So thank you to John Franklin that her things survive. And also I was very lucky because of who my father was and the relationships he had with people that I was allowed access to some personal private collections, family collections, and was able to find some of the really heart-searching materials that haven't been allowed into archives before. And it was a very difficult process actually then to choose which to include. Space, of course, comes into it, but also with some of them I wanted to protect some of the women. You find, I'm sure, Judith, you felt this too, that you feel a fierce sense of protectiveness as a biographer sometimes. You want to make sure that the story's getting out rightly, correctly, and that things aren't going to be misconstrued. And there are a few letters, there's one in particular of Kathleen Scott that I was really didn't know whether to put in or not, and it was one that's only recently been discovered, or at least released, of a note that a scribbled note that was in his chest pocket and found on his body when he was found in the wilds of the south. And it essentially tells him, if there's any risk to take or leave, you must take it, and if you risk your life and you lose your life, that's okay by me. And it was a very difficult letter to read, and a very powerful one. And I think you have to sort of understand a lot of Kathleen's story to understand that she's not just being completely callous and that she doesn't love him, she wants to go to his death because she wants the glory, that actually it was the ultimate self-sacrifice.
Judith, in a way, the discovery of yours is in the structure, comes out of the structure of the book. You interleave their lives and then interleave them again. And so you uncover the synchronicities and the relationships between them.
Because my first biography was just a single subject, it's a very, very different kind of writing. And you suddenly realise, though, that aspects of someone's life that you think are unique to them, the conflicts they encounter or their dreams or their aspirations, are actually generational. And I found wonderful kind of continuations of behaviour across all of them. That, for instance, you'd read a biography of Zelda and they'd go on about her turning cartwheels or hosting cocktail parties from the bath, and then you realise they're all doing it. I mean, that's a sort of trivial example of how, you know, people are formed by their times, and a biographer's task is always to balance the historical with the very personal narrative. And I was fascinated with trying to get that balance right with these women. And obviously, the more I researched their lives, I then also discovered not only that they had much in common for having come of age at the 20s, but that actually they knew each other, they knew other people, they were written about, photographed by the same people. So it was sort of like having a party and then discovering that people, all the people you invited, actually knew each other much better than you originally thought they did. The 20s in particular was such an enclosed space of time in history anyway, because it was bookended by the First World War and then the Great Depression. It was much easier to tell that story of six lives than it would be maybe more ragged, more long-term stories.
Why should these stories be of interest to us today as women in the 21st century, since this is where we started this podcast?
For me personally, I thought it was fascinating because I love polar history. I love the stories of adventure. For me, it was a rediscovery, not only of the stories of adventure, but actually discovering the men as well as the women. So you're hearing these incredible voices of these women who are totally forgotten throughout history and the role, essential role that they played. But it's not really a sort of feminist book, this one. It's more about giving a completely different slant on well-known history. Actually, a lot of these stories are very well known, and then we see a completely different side of Scott. We see a completely different side of Shackleton. You know, suddenly realize that Shackleton went to the south, became an explorer to win the heart of the woman he loved. I mean, who of us knew that? I certainly didn't know that. And so it was just a wonderful discovery, and I think it is incredibly important to remember that these people were very human. Yeah, they were brothers, they were fathers. I think their achievements are all the more special because of their human failings.
Obviously, my women were much better known than Carrie's already, but what I found from writing about them as a whole was a sense of how much was achieved in the 20s in terms of experimenting with your sexuality, with your sense of who you were, your identity, and that a lot of stuff that we thought as women that we'd fought for and achieved in the 60s and early 70s, actually these women were experimenting with all that stuff in the 20s, and that for various reasons, the intervention of the Second World War, the Depression, that sort of flapper experiment, which I like to think of it as, kind of went underground. But as I said, a lot of what we thought we were doing first, they'd actually been attempting much earlier.
Books podcast from guardian.co.uk.